Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The Market Musings Podcast. Well, hello and welcome back to the Market Musings Podcast here from Stockbox, where today we are joined by Patrick Cheetham, the Executive Chairman of Sunrise Resources. The first time we've got Patrick on the podcast. Of course, we've done a few interviews with Patrick, with yourself, on Stockbox, and we do a special feature on your PIOS project. But the first time, really, we're going to be learning a bit more about you, the man sort of behind the company. So welcome on to the podcast. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Thanks very much. Yeah,
good.
Should be good.
Good. And Dan Flynn is, of course, joining us as the co-host on the podcast today. So, Dan, are you doing okay?
Yeah, great. Good start. Busy start to the week, and looking forward to this interview.
Yeah, an interesting start to the week for sure. I mean, of course, you know, we're not talking about oil, but oil shot up on the global tensions. Bitcoin seems to still be holding up quite nicely as well, amid global risk, and gold is also holding up. So, a fair few things going on there.
Yeah, exactly.
At the moment. It's certainly not a boring summer so far, which normally it is. So, see how that continues. But, Patrick, so it'd be nice to learn a bit more about yourself, really. Were you interested in rocks from a very young age, a typical sort of geologist, or did you sort of fall into the sector accidentally? You can go back as far as you like, really. Depends how much you want to reveal. You could start university or start before, but it'd be nice to know a bit about.
Yeah, I mean, like roots. A lot of geologists, it was kind of start at a pretty early age. Like when I was 16, I really enjoyed geography and the physical side of geography. And I was lucky enough to go to a school that actually taught geology as an A-level subject. So I'd already done 2 years of geology before I went to university. So I was pretty hooked by that time. So when I did go to university, you know, I chose a very applied course and did mining geology at the Royal School of Mines at Imperial College.
Okay. What was more interesting for you on the geography side of things at school? It wasn't the town planning side. It was perhaps more
No, absolutely not. No. It was very much the, the sort of landscapes and the rocks and, you know, the teacher we had at school was a geologist himself who had worked in industry and he took us around a lot of the old mines in the north of England. We used to do mineral collecting and, it was just a lot of fun.
We never did that at school, you know. I actually did very well on the town planning side, which surprised everyone, I think. But for some reason, I excelled at that section of my geography course and didn't do too well on the other things we were taught, which was, I think, more about sort of coastal erosion. I know our field trips involved going to sort of the Scarborough, Flamborough Head, actually. That's where we went, Flamborough Head, and looking at the erosion of the clays. And of course, you've got your plate tectonics as well. But now the town planning side was better for me for some reason. I don't know why. But we didn't do a lot, I'll be honest, on sort of the formation of rocks or, like you say, mines. Maybe that would have been a bit more up my street. I don't know. But I never experienced that. But I don't know, Dan, what was your geography? Did you pursue it or not? Was it just a standard subject for you at school?
It was a pretty similar experience to you, Mark. It was mainly the town planning side. I remember we had a trip to Swanage. I think geology separated off as a separate GCSEs, which I fortunately didn't do. So, like you, went down the town planning side of things.
Right.
Yeah. I think a lot of it has to do with the teacher, doesn't it? I mean, if the teacher, it doesn't matter what the subject is or which part of the subject, it's whether they inspire you. And I think we were just lucky.
Yes.
For me, anyway.
Very, very important. Yeah, very, very important. Okay. So you went to university and studied mining geology. So was there anything particular that stood out to you during that 3 years? Any particular mineral or commodity that drew you, or rock formations or jurisdictions, anything that stood out?
Look, it was, very small classes in that degree course. Was about only really, six or seven people doing that particular degree course in any one year. So it was very personal attention. We did a lot of field trips, a lot of, not just in the UK, but in Spain, and actually going around various mines. So you got exposure to different sides of the potential business that we're actually going into. And, we were lucky that the course was actually run by people who'd been in industry, had very good industry connections. So, when we came out of university, there were jobs waiting. So, okay. And we also did, during the second year vacation, we also went into industry as well to do like a placement type of job. So for me, I went to work on a copper exploration project in British Columbia in Canada, working out in the sticks. And that was for a company called Imperial Metals. So that was like a vacation job, but it did set me up to look at different aspects of the the commercial side of mining geology as well.
So you didn't go down a lot of geologists we speak to in this space are Camborne School of Mines graduates. So you you didn't, that didn't tempt you down there. You
a lot of rivalry. A lot of rivalry between the two. Not so much now, because Imperial College or the Royal School of Mines is not quite what it was for mining geology. It's kind of very strong on engineering and mining, but not so much on mining geology anymore, and doesn't have the same industry connection. So if I was making the choice today, maybe I'd go to Camborne School of Mines.
So you did a stint in BC in your younger years. What was that like then, working on the ground there?
Well, it was very exciting. It was a copper exploration project in the middle of British Columbia. I think there are, for me anyway, there were a number of kind of light bulb type moments, in my career. And certainly that was one of those there. There was one of the guys who was working on the project, he was actually one of the mule skinners. Actually, I'll describe what that is. Actually, that's someone who drives a bulldozer. That's the slang for it. But he was also a prospector, and he kind of really showed me that you can actually make quite a bit of money in the business too. So that was kind of one of the light bulb moments when he kind of taught me how he interacts with mining companies from the other side. But we also got to do some exciting things, like my first helicopter supported exploration, a few run-ins with grizzly bears. It's quite exciting.
Was that your first job in mineral exploration, that one?
It was. It was a vacation job, so it was like a summer job, but in the second year of university. But it was.
Sure. And did you get the bug from there and wanted to keep doing
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was very set on a career path, really, to work in the exploration business. Less so underground. I was never quite keen on working underground, but, to work, in the open air, in the exploration business, that was always a goal.
Sure. And aside from Canada, did you get to work in any other, mining hotbeds around the world?
Yeah, so when I graduated, again, lucky in timing, it was a time when there were lots of jobs in the industry available. I was interviewed by a company called Western Mining Corporation, which isn't around anymore. It was taken over in a merger with BHP. They always recruited from Imperial College School of Mines. And the guy that recruited me there is a guy called Roy Woodall, who was perhaps one of the greatest kind of exploration leaders that I've ever seen. And Western Mining were a very, very successful company. They found the Cambalda nickel deposits. And around the time that I joined them, they just discovered the Olympic Dam, you know, the giant Olympic Dam copper gold uranium project in South Australia. So it was a very exciting time to join them. If I had, I had an offer from Western Mining, but also from Imperial Metals, a company that employed me as a vacation student. And one started much earlier than the other, so I thought, well, I'll go to Australia. I looked on the map, and I was supposed to be working in a place called Kalgoorlie, one of the gold mining towns. I looked at the maps, and there was all these lakes around Kalgoorlie. So I thought, great, I'll be able to go sailing and do this, that, and the other. But actually, it turned out they're all dry salt lakes in the end. But that was a bit of a surprise.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm. Those are the days, I think. It's way past mine and Dan's time at university where, yeah, employers would come and prospect fresh graduates. I think now people tend to leave and, yeah, well, very few, I think, actually follow their path that they did in their degree in. But, you know, it's different times. So,
it is.
So what was that? Very different times, yeah, indeed. So you went out to Australia. Okay, and that did anything stand out to you from that experience then with Western Mining?
Yeah, as I say, it was a great company to work for. And, you know, I was fortunate to – I only worked with them for a few years, but I was lucky in that I was involved in two discoveries that they made at the time, both gold. One was called Davyhurst. That went into production and is still producing today. Then another project called 11 Bells. So, yeah, it was a great place to learn. In many ways, I would have probably benefited from spending longer working there. But they had a distinct career path where after a few years in exploration, they wanted you to work underground. And that was never really very attractive to me. So at that stage, I set off started my kind of my own career with my own companies after that.
The shift to managing the companies yourself, how was
that? It was quite a shift. And what I did, I went back to the UK for various family reasons from Australia. And what I joined up with another chap called Stephen Stone. And we basically raised seed capital in the UK to go back out to Australia to set up a company called Dragon Mining. So we listed Dragon Mining on the stock exchange in Australia in 1987, literally 1 week before the October 87 crash. Not many people remember that very well, but it was something like, I think the Dow went down 22% in one day on what was called Black Monday. And so, you know, we raised our money, which was a good thing, in a flotation a week before that crash. But it was kind of 2 years of death by a thousand cuts with the share price. We did make a discovery of gold, which went into production in a joint venture. But it was quite a learning curve to go through, you know, very difficult times at that point in time. It was entirely. And, you know, things were looking pretty dire, but then kind of just suddenly there was a phone call from a broker saying, you know, well, we think things are picking up. Would you guys like to, you know, to raise some money and crack on with your projects again? And that's what happened. So things and it turned around very quickly when it did turn around.
Okay, so you were able to get through that period then, effectively having raised money a week before the crash, and you just battled on through. And then you had the discovery during the tough time, did you?
Yes, we did, and it went into production it was a relatively small scale, in joint venture with a company called Sons of Gwalia. Our main project at that time was a platinum discovery that we made. It also with a lateritic chromium deposit as well, called Range Well.
Okay. And how old were you when you did that then? That was your first
I set off doing that when I was 26. That was
okay.
When we floated Dragon Mining.
Well, what was it like to float a company back then?
Well, they were very heady days. I mean, the company, you know, we raised money at 25 cents. When we floated, and in that first week of trading, the first day it went from 25 cents to 65 cents. It was quite crazy times. And it was, you know, there's a lot going on in Perth. It was a time of the America's Cup when Alan Bond won the America's Cup in Perth. So yeah, there was a lot going on, and it was very much a fun time.
Yeah, were there far fewer floats at that time, or would you say it's about the same? I was wondering if there's more excitement perhaps around a new company, because information certainly.
I think, to be honest, was the excitement around any new company at that point in time, such was a market at the time.
Right. Okay. So that's quite interesting that you did that at 26. That's pretty young to be, just starting a business venture anyway, but to actually get a float away at something like that is pretty.
Times were very different, and not just in terms of sort of market interest, but the. You know, the PR and the IR landscape were very different then. One of my great mentors was a guy called John Greenhall. He was one of our seed capital shareholders in that company. And John ran a PR company called City of London PR, and they specialized in Australian mining companies and introducing them to the UK market. And so he ran our PR and IR at that time, and we actually raised our money through an advert in the Financial Times, which you could never do today. And when we floated Dragon, we were covered with a full half-page spread with photos on the front of the company's page in the Financial Times. You can't get that sort of PR today.
No. And was there a lot of interest among retail investors for these sorts of quite niche exploration stocks?
Well, a huge, huge interest, and also just, you know, a larger number of institutional players would play in the junior space in those days. Okay. You know, now they have their, you know, sort of market cap restrictions, and so you know, for companies like Sunrise today, you know, it's very hard to find institutional investors.
Is that just a shift in the markets in terms of risk management?
Yes, exactly that. Yeah. That.
So what happened then with Dragon then in the end?
So in the end, because I set up the company with a chap called Steve Stone, and we were running as joint managing directors, and I decided to leave and go off on my own and do it again. So Dragon provided seed funding to me and my wife, actually, to set up another company called Archean Gold.
Okay.
So that was the second public company and the second public float in Australia.
Okay. And that was also an ASX, listed.
It was, yeah.
With ASX, with Australian-focused projects.
Entirely Australian, yeah. So the companies had a portfolio of about five or six projects, gold primarily, one silver project.
And so I understand that Archean was ultimately taken over by Lachlan Resources. Can you walk us through, you know, the steps that from exploration and discovery and what led to that?
Yeah, so it's interesting, really, because it kind of illustrates the benefits of having a portfolio-based approach to mineral exploration, because the project that really came to the fore was right at the back of our prospectus. It was, you know, not our lead project. It wasn't even a second tier project. It was a third tier project. But what it was the discovery of that particular mineral deposit, which was a silver deposit, was made by myself and my wife. We were out we'd been taken out to look at a project by a prospector that I knew, and whilst we were looking there, we came across an old drill hole, which had been drilled, and it was drilled presumably for gold. All the drill chips were still on the ground. And I decided to pan off the drill chips, and in the bottom of the gold pan was a green mineral. And the person that taught me to pan at Western Mining Corporation said, "If you ever get anything green in the gold pan, get it assayed for silver because it could be silver chloride." So that's what we did, and we reassayed the drill piles and came back with values up to, I think, something like 300 grams per ton of silver, which is, you know, several ounces per ton of silver. And then when you walked in front of the drill, where the old drill hole was this outcrop of a breccia, which when we assayed it was about 1,000 grams of silver. So that was the start of it. So we re-drilled that, and every hole we put in came back with thick intervals of silver, with some zinc as well. And that was really, it was still in the exploration phase when Lachlan Resources came along and made a bid for the company, a hostile bid.
Okay. Did it come as a surprise, the bid?
It was, I suppose the discovery of silver was certainly a surprise. So that became the key project in the company. And eventually the silver deposit was mined. It shows what can happen quickly and what can happen on the turn of, just a few samples.
Exactly. So, I mean, in terms of the timeline on that then, from, let's say, forming the company to basically making the discovery and then the takeover, what are we talking?
We're talking sort of 12 months.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. Very quick then. Okay.
Yeah.
That's good. Okay.
So, we drilled that for about, we were drilling on it for about a year ourselves. And that's when the bid came in from Lachlan.
Okay. It's interesting that, isn't it? It's sort of, you don't really hear about that these days, do you? I don't think. But what do you think drove that? Was it luck in the discovery? Was it, or maybe not?
Luck, it was a combination of things. It was the fact that Western Mining used to pan off all their drill samples before they assayed them, and I was taught how to do to pan samples properly. So it was the fact that I just remembered that that statement by the guy who taught me how to pan, say, anything green in the gold pan, get it assayed for silver. So it was serendipity, really.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So what happened then after that? I mean, that was a very rapid 12-month period.
At that stage, I'd recruited someone to come in as managing director of Archean Gold. And whilst that was all going on, I came back to the UK and set up Tertiary Minerals, which is obviously a network. But we did this on the AIM market, obviously, this time. So this was Tertiary Minerals, so-called, because two reasons, I guess. It was the third public company that I was setting up, but also the first exploration project we had in Tertiary was exploring for gold in the Tertiary volcanics in eastern Greenland. It seemed an appropriate name.
So this was, what year was Tertiary set up?
Tertiary was set up originally as a private company in 1997.
Okay.
And we ran it as a private company for 2 or 3 years. Not particularly because that was the ambition. It's just that the markets were not brilliant at that time. So we had to wait for the opportunity to float the company on AIM.
Okay. And was the idea to do the same thing, if you could, repeat what you did at Lachlan?
Yes, that's right. I mean, the funding for Tertiary as a private company came from various shareholders in Archean Gold.
Okay. Archean, not Lachlan. So what were you effectively doing with Tertiary then when in those private years?
Yeah, putting together a portfolio of projects. We did one exploration campaign in Greenland, I think whilst it was a private company. And we also were putting together some projects in Sweden as well.
Okay.
And had you been to those jurisdictions before, or were they?
No, Greenland was pretty new. I mean, it was, it was really just a very much a conceptual project. So, the East Greenland's a very difficult and expensive place to explore, but, if you organize your logistics well, then you can piggyback on various sort of scientific expeditions that are running at the time. We ran the project out of a military base in East Greenland, a Danish military base. We basically took a remote sensing approach to the exploration. So we did a lot of preparatory satellite evaluation looking for anomalies, and the project was largely field checking a lot of these anomalies. It wasn't particularly successful in that sense, in terms of yielding any new discoveries.
Sure. When you pick these jurisdictions, are you looking for a combination of like the right geology and the right operating environment?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's it's an interesting point, really, because, you know, what I traditionally look for is political stability.
Right.
So that's a key thing. You know, from a geological perspective, you know, I think there's most jurisdictions will be favorable for one sort of mineral deposit or another. Mm. So, you know, so to me, political stability is the first thing. But actually, one thing that I have learned through my career is that, you know, political risk comes in many different forms. And, you know, within tertiary minerals, for example, we had, you know, quite involved in Scandinavia, and we had a good discovery of a new industrial minerals project, a fluorspar deposit. But that was 10 years ago, and we're still trying to get that fully permitted. And so, you know, still, you wouldn't think that politically Sweden was risky, but it can be. Then it comes in a different form. It's not, you know, it's not corruption. It's it comes from, you know, environmental issues primarily, or conflicts of interest with, you know, reindeer herding, for example.
Mm. And has that got more? Has those sorts of issues got more significant as the years have gone on?
I mean, I guess generally the trend is yes, they do become more significant. But I think right now there's a bit of a pushback, you know, as the world discovers that it really needs minerals and it needs critical minerals, then, you know, I think there's been a pushback on those sort of issues.
Okay. That's an interesting point, because, of course, the sort of companies you worked on before seem to have pretty either rapid success or certainly a rapid exit, let's say, for you, whereas, of course, tertiary, you know, sort of, I don't know, would you say you're sort of happy with the progress? Would you have been more encouraged to see some more crystallization events at tertiary? We'll talk about Sunrise in a moment as well, but just on tertiary, with it being the one after Archean.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we would have preferred to see, you know, more in the way of or an earlier kind of success. But, you know, there have been in tertiary a number of commercial technical successes within tertiary. Tertiary's just had some bad luck, really, in the sense that, you know, we made a big rare earth discovery in Saudi Arabia in the, you know, early 2000s, far too far ahead of the pack, really, in terms of, you know, the rare earth story. But there we came unstuck with, you know, political issues in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, we went on from there to discover a big fluorspar deposit in Nevada in tertiary. But metallurgy, and whilst a very large deposit, over 100 million tons, some metallurgical issues. So, you know, these things, they do come up, and, you know, there have been lots of opportunities within tertiary for people to make money along the way. But obviously today the share price is fairly depressed, and, you know, we've got a job to do to deliver on that.
Well, of course, we did talk to Richard. We did a podcast with Richard, of course, who's sort of leading tertiary now. So it's I guess it's really on to him to do that with your, I don't know, mentoring or presence in the background, let's say. But when did Sunrise come into the picture? Because that's where you are. I think
Sunrise was a spin-off from tertiary. So what happened is back in, I suppose, 2005, when it was spun off, tertiary was exploring in Finland, looking for a particular style of mineralization, iron oxide, copper, gold. And as part of that process, we did a lot of work looking at the regional magnetics. And when I was doing that, and really this was a computer discovery, in a sense that we found a new kimberlite area in Finland. So, and we found them just by looking at the government magnetic anomalies online. And there was these bullseye type magnetic anomalies, which are characteristic of kimberlites. And when we started delving into the exploration history, we saw that De Beers had held one of these areas. And in their drill log, they'd logged kimberlite. And so when we then went into the core archive and pulled out the drill core, and there was no kimberlite in the drill core. And so we could have walked away at that point. But it would just seemed all rather a little bit suspicious. We re-drilled the anomaly, and indeed it was kimberlite. And the reason we drilled it is because we'd also found lots of other bullseye anomalies in the same region. Mm-hmm. So what we discovered, and this was in tertiary originally, was a new kimberlite province in Finland, which is now called the Kuusamo province. But tertiary was doing other things and it didn't really quite fit. So it was spun off as an entitlement issue to tertiary shareholders listed on the AIM exchange as a separate vehicle. And it was actually called Sunrise Diamonds at that time, not Sunrise Resources.
Mm. Obviously, there was an involvement into Sunrise Resources.
Yeah, I mean, it was another technical success, but not an economic success, as often is the case with diamonds.
Right.
So we found a number of new kimberlites. Some of them were weakly diamondiferous, but not of a grade that was sufficiently attractive. The kimberlites were quite deeply eroded, and the larger and perhaps richer parts of the kimberlites had been eroded away. So we basically had to kind of find another direction. So that's when we diverged, I suppose, our interests into more traditional base metals and gold.
Mm. Moving forward today, what would you say is like unique about Sunrise's approach to exploration and its strategy? What do you think sets you apart?
A good question. And there are literally hundreds of mineral exploration companies out there. So I don't think anyone is actually unique in that sense. But I think what we do is we identify projects that have value very cheaply and make cheap acquisitions. So we always go for 100% ownership where we can. So we like to stake our own claims. And we like to weed out opportunities that perhaps other people haven't seen. So, and because we kind of moved into Nevada, we saw opportunities in Nevada in industrial minerals that others we felt hadn't really pursued. And in some cases, with good reason. Industrial minerals are not on everyone's search list when it comes to public companies. But they do have the characteristics that they can be very valuable, can spin off good cash flow. And because not everyone's looking for them, there are opportunities around that you can pick up quite cheaply. But if we kind of backtrack a little bit, the first industrial mineral project that we got involved in Nevada was actually an accidental discovery. So we were looking for gold. And in fact, the area where, and this is the area of our CS natural pozzolan deposit, we were looking for gold. And in fact, we're right next door to a very large gold exploration project being run by a US company. But what we found, we were basically using a particular technology to search for gold. And what it actually found for us was this deposit of natural pozzolan, which is, something which is used as cementitious material. And the deposit looked like it could be quite large. So that was really our first intro into industrial minerals in Nevada.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about industrial minerals. Obviously, they aren't promoted as much in the exploration space as perhaps the base metals and stuff. But when you actually make a discovery, is there a lot of interest from potential partners?
There is. And, I guess the harder part is that the companies that you're dealing with tend to be private companies as well.
Mm.
So they have a kind of a different outlook to public companies. They are very secretive normally. So one of the kind of biggest difficulties that we have really is, to get across to people the level of interest in these projects, because when we sign CAs and we sign agreements with these companies to do test work, then you know, they want to be very secretive about it, so we can't really talk much about it in the public arena. And actually consummating deals is trickier as well, because you know, we have obligations when we do a deal to release the results to the public, to announce the details of the deal, whereas you know, the private company don't want to know what they've paid, don't want people to know what they've paid for a particular asset. So that represents challenges. And in fact, on our lead CS project this year, we actually had to terminate, or discussions on the particular project were terminated, simply because the counterparty wouldn't allow us to talk about the sort of deal we were doing. So that's one of the main challenges with industrial minerals, I think.
Do you think, you mentioned earlier that industrial minerals are not really on the list of most commodity investors. How do you get it on the radar? That this not quite as a...
Yeah, I think, you know, when we do deals, and I think those deals can speak for themselves. So, for example, with our PH project, which we talked about before, this is a clay project. You know, we spent on that project maybe £15,000-£20,000. And when we did a deal on that particular project with a Spanish company, the deal was, you know, for a buyout of $1.4 million. So, you know, something that we spent £15,000 on, suddenly has a price tag, a high price tag. Although that deal, you know, it was an option, it didn't actually eventuate, or it hasn't eventuated yet, then it does illustrate the value in these projects and you know, identifying them. Because a lot of the producing industrial minerals companies don't do exploration. So, you know, when someone brings them a new deposit of the thing that they're producing, then, you know, it does spark interest.
Mm.
And you, so we've got to get the message across. We do it by delivering on the deals. Yes. You know, they've been slow, but I think, you know, any one of our projects would command a sales price which is well in excess of our current market cap.
Why do you think the deals have been slow? Just the environment at the moment?
It's partly the environment. I think it's partly the conservative nature of the counterparties that we're talking to. You know, things, you know, we take the example of our CS project. As I say, looking to produce there, and we're fully permitted for production, looking to produce something which is a replacement for cement. Mm-hmm. So it reduces the CO2 emissions. But the cement companies are terribly conservative. They've been making cement in the same way for, you know, over 100 years.
Mm.
And whilst they know they have to reduce their carbon emissions and substitute some of their traditional materials with new materials like natural pozzolan, they're just slow to adopt. And I think also with the change of government to Trump, there is this perception that that some of the green agendas might be rolled back. And certainly natural pozzolan is part of that green agenda. But the reality is that those regulations are actually made on a state rather than a federal level. So, you know, it's not a real concern.
Mm. And the upside for Sunrise then is to, get an exit? Is that the main thing, really? Get cash in the bank, retain the royalty?
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And I think we can do that with industrial minerals. And I can kind of almost hear my shareholders saying, we've said they've been saying that for quite a while. And that is true. And we acknowledge that. But, you know, the imperatives for using natural pozzolan are just increasing. And as is the level of interest. So we will get something over the line, but it is taking longer than we expected.
Okay. And I've just got one question to let Dan finish off, but just because you've been around the sector for quite a while, Patrick, you've seen it's very cyclical, as we know. I like to always ask mining CEOs or geologists about that cyclical nature and where you think we are right now. We've heard the same sort of mantra for quite a while now that, you know, the world's crying out for these commodities, but we're still not really seeing it play out in terms of market valuations, M&A, etc. Do you have a sense of where we are at the moment in the cycle and where it's heading?
Well, you know, in the actual commodity prices, then, you know, I think that, you know, as you say, the commodity prices are all very strong. And, you know, if you look at those companies that are producing gold, for example, you know, they're doing very well at these prices. You know, commodity, you know, the gold price, I think, is strong and will remain stronger for longer. You know, personally, you know, I'm invested in physical gold. I think it's, you know, all the things that affect the gold price, like instability, you know, the American dollar, the weaker American dollar, they all point to a higher gold price. But it's not translating to the juniors yet. And I think one of the major issues is that there has not been a major discovery in the hands of a junior explorer for quite some time. And, you know, I think that is what is going to be required to, you know, to kind of light up the market a little bit. You know, it will trickle down eventually. But the prices are, you know, the prices of so many junior stocks are so bombed out that they, in terms of the cycle of share price, I do think they have to be at the bottom, and, you know, set for an upturn. But it needs a trigger. I mean, one of the issues I think is that there are too many other type of speculative investments out there at the moment in the tech space. You know, I think, was it something like 8 out of 10 recent fundraisers have been in the, you know, Bitcoin treasury space.
Yes. Well, I was going to, yeah, maybe you should announce a Bitcoin treasury.
So, you know, I think it, you know, I have been through a few cycles. This one is perhaps one of the longest.
Right. Okay.
It will turn, but it's going to take time.
Yeah. I think you're right about there's a lot of interest in that space at the moment, but you can't deny that commodities are real, aren't they?
Absolutely.
You know, whereas,
yeah, and you know, as we go into more instability, people want real physical assets.
Exactly.
Like gold.
Exactly. Dan, any final thoughts from you?
Just one final question. In short, Patrick, what developments over the next 12 months do you think stand to get Sunrise's share price moving upwards?
So I think it could come from two sides. So I think there's the, you know, our industrial minerals projects where we have to deliver on and, you know, doing the sort of deals that actually demonstrate to people the value in those projects that we, you know, that we as a board see there. As I said, I think the, you know, the sort of deals that we can do on individual projects would pass on our entire market capitalization, but also on our, you know, on our base metal and gold projects. You know, we're seeing increased interest in those projects as, you know, from a partnering point of view, you know, as the commodity prices stay strong. So, you know, we have, for example, you know, Kinross are exploring on one of our gold projects. Kinross is a major gold producer. They have that under option. You know, we have different royalty interests, one being the Garfield project, which is operated by Guardian Metal Resources. You know, that was an original prospecting discovery that I made, which we sold into the forerunner of Guardian Metal Resources. You know, and that these things, royalty interests can become valuable as these projects advance. So I think there's a number of potential catalysts going forward.
Excellent.
Good stuff. Well, thanks very much, Patrick. That's good to know. I've learned a fair bit about your past that I didn't know before. So
not too much,
yeah,
I hope.
Nice. You've kept well. Maybe there's some stuff you've smartly kept, but yeah, I mean, for this sector, that's really quite nice to learn about that. So, well, yeah, let's hope that the sector does indeed start to turn in the favour, and as you say, you can start to realise some exits from that portfolio that you've built up. But thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay.
Step in into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.